This is our abduction special. I'm Jerry Pippin, and Elaine Douglas is with us, and she's with JAR, the abduction magazine, and she's the board editor, and she's promised to get more issues out. Is that right, Elaine?
Yes, soon. Very soon we're going to have an issue of JAR, a new issue.
We appreciate you coming on and talking to us about all of this, and the phone calls have been very interesting so far.
I think so. Would you like to talk about the Jim Sparks case?
Yeah, we can. You want to do that right now for a minute?
If you want to,
go ahead.
Have you ever? I don't know if you've ever met Jim. He's a well-known abductee. And his book is 2006. The name of his book is The Keepers, An Alien Message for the...
Yeah, I've had him on the air many times.
Yes. And now, if you...
Now, if I remember correctly, they line him up in a camp, sort of. They lay him down, and... Isn't that right?
Well, Jim Sparks is superficially known because he was trained in an alien language. You know, he's made to sit in front of a screen and practice letters. But the thing is, if anybody wants to kind of get an idea of what the aliens are, what I meant earlier when I talked about behavior modification and capitulation, they should read Jim Sparks' book, because many of the elements that can be found that are very important, the fundamental elements of the behavior modification that is used by the aliens, can be found in Jim Sparks' book. In the beginning of his book, he tells you that he loathes the aliens. He loathes them. He is so brought down and so angry about the fact that they pick him up and keep him prisoner and force him to practice letters and put him through a whirlwind, and that he loathes them. And he's trying everything that he can do to get free himself from their grasp. By the end of the book, he is reverential. He is figuratively down on his knees worshiping the aliens. So that his attitude is completely transformed from the beginning to the end of the book. This process requires several years to consummate. And if you read the book, you will see how they managed to do it. And the elements that they used were 1, trauma, 2, coercion, and 3, narcissism. They took him in, they repeatedly subjected him to trauma. They didn't walk him out of his house. They didn't float him through a window. They set up some sort of a device or a process whereby when he was taken, he found himself in like the eye of a hurricane. Not the eye, that's calm, but in a tornado. His whole body was grabbed and whirled around, and it completely lost control of his body in a terrifying experience that ended up depositing him in one of their places, the alien places. I guess it was a craft or wherever it was that he ends up and it turns into a calm situation. But he was taken in this way, oh, I don't know, 100 times. And it was extremely traumatic to him. And psychologists will tell you that if you want to break people down, traumatize them repeatedly, not just one trauma, but repeatedly. The article I wrote on Jim Sparks, which I published in JAR, is called The Breaking of Jim Sparks, because that's exactly what it was. So the first element they used was trauma. And then the next element they used was coercion. Basically, he's their prisoner, and they force him. They actually hold him immobilized in a sitting position in front of this screen, and they use punishment and torture they tell him that he's going to have to write these alien letters. And if he protests or he doesn't want to write the letters or he won't concentrate on the task at hand, they introduce very painful experiences and torture to get him to comply. Now, that's the negative side. On the positive side, you see, we were talking earlier about how some abductees report positive experiences, and I was saying things like, well, they take you on Monday and you have a good time, they take you on Friday and you have a miserable time. In the abduction cases, you'll always find this interplay of pleasure and pain. And you find it very much in Jim's case. The way that they seduced him, the way that they got his attention, the way that they captured his mind and persuaded him that their purposes were at least interesting and something that he should encounter, was that they presented him with a long series of short films in which they showed him himself in earlier periods of history. They went all the way back to the prehistoric period. They showed him a film of a group of people in prehistory, cavemen, and there was somebody there who looked just like Jim Sparks. And then they showed him a scene in ancient Rome, and there was somebody there that looked just like Jim. And then they showed him a scene in the 14th century, and there was somebody there that looked just like Jim. And then they showed him a scene from the early colonial period, and there was somebody there that looked just like Jim in the scenarios, these little movies that they showed him. And he remarks, you can read it in his book, he says, the persons that he saw that looked just, they had curly black hair just like him, and they had this and that, a nose just like him. And he begins to lovingly appreciate these images that are being presented to him that look just like him. And then there's one from the Civil War period, and it looks just like him. And pretty soon, he gets all involved in this, and he turns to the aliens and he says, do you mean you've been following my family line all the way back to the cavemen?
Let's bring in Thomas Reed, who has had some experiences. And Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jerry.
Good to have you. Last time I talked to you, you were down in St. Augustine looking around, thinking about moving back to Florida. Have you made a decision?
Yeah, I love St. Augustine. I just can't get my house here to sell, so it's going to have to wait a little while. But
Elaine was talking about with Jim Sparks, we'll get into your details here in just a minute, but did you have anything similar to that?
Well, she touched on one thing that I experienced pretty much what Disney touched on with this, like a hurricane type of thing. I've mentioned before, and I think even on your show, that what my brother experienced and I in 1966, we referenced it as almost feeling like we were in a wave from like in the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean. You hit a big wave, and all of a sudden it like wraps around you. And you turn, and you're not sure which is up, which is left, which is right, and you get swallowed up in this wave. And then all of a sudden, there's a calm and an empty still and like a complete silence, and it's different. And it happens very sudden like that. So that part of it I did find.
Now, why don't you tell our audience a little. Some people have heard your shows on our website and on Inception Radio. You did some great shows with Chase and some other people. Why don't you tell me and our audience in a kind of a brief fashion what actually your abduction experiences were. They started early age, right?
Well, the first case with our family was 1954 with my mother in Moosehead Lake, which was the same fourth week of June that airline heading from New York to London and dispatched that F-94 fighter jet to intercept a couple of crafts. That was 50 miles or so away from my parents when they were in this cabin, if you will. But my brother and I, our first incident that we remember was in 1966. And my parents had a 75-acre horse farm up in Massachusetts. And we found ourselves, I know I'm short on time here, so we found ourselves at the corner of a line there, a property line, and we were accompanied by a few figures, if you will. I was first, or some figures behind me, and my brother was last. And we had broke through this line of trees. It was at the top of our property line, probably about 300 yards from the house. And we had walked by, or seemingly walked by, this large rock, and then we came to a wishbone-type tree that we were able to see what looked like a pile of dirt behind it. And it was a little bit lower. We had to step down off this little bit of a ledge, and we came onto this craft that was probably, I'm going to say, 60 feet round, I guess. At the time, it looked like a huge pile of dirt. You know, it was dark. And there was a figure out. If this was the ruler, we came onto the craft about the 6-inch mark. This figure was about the 10-inch mark. And it was nerve-wracking. I mean, I walked up to it first. Again, there was like a calm that comes over you a little bit, and you feel it's going to be okay, and you proceed further. And the closer you go, the more you feel it's going to be all right. And the odd thing was I had reached this craft, what I thought was first, and paused for a moment, and the figure kind of had a moment of still. And the next thing I knew, I was inside the craft, and I was in this light, very bright holding area, if you will. It wasn't that big, but it was part of a hallway. It's like this hallway formed a question mark, and I was at this bottom of this question mark, and it was a very soft, what I was standing on was very soft. And I had a figure to my left now, and that brought me to the right of this angled hallway, and I had actually passed my brother now, but somehow I guess he was in there first. I don't know how that happened, but he was there. And again, with a figure, he was very stock still, and I went around him to the right and came down the rest of this curvature. It looks like this hallway followed the contour of the craft to the front of this top part of the donut, if you will. If you cut the craft in three parts, I was now at the top part of this donut. And I was handed off, if you will, to another figure that was just inside this doorway. And at that point, it was almost like a guide had taken me and dropped me off, and now I was with this other group, and I was to interact with them and somehow. But there wasn't really much interaction. I really couldn't understand anything that they were trying to relay to me. And they also projected some images, which Elaine touched on earlier. I was nervous. I kept looking behind me for my brother, who was in the hallway. He didn't come all the way up. He just stayed behind. And so I kept looking over my shoulder for him, and there was a touch on my shoulder. And I looked up. This being was taller than me. I was pretty young. He's so much taller, and I started to feel calm again. It was that moment of, I don't know, peace, I guess, at that point. And then there was a nod to this individual that was at a table in front of me, and there was a seemingly identical table to the left at about 3 o'clock, and this other table was in front of me just off-center, but it would have been about 3 and 9 o'clock, if you will. And they look the same. Figures were not moving much. They don't move much. They kind of stay where they are. And next thing I know, there was an image that came up that wrapped about from 3 o'clock to 9 o'clock. This entire front of the craft had a star pattern and these bright, much brighter stars, if you will, that kind of formed the shape of what I remember as looking like a boot. And it came off to the left, the boot went to the left. And that was up for a few seconds, I guess. Maybe it could have been more, but that's all I remember it. And then all of a sudden, bang, there was this image of this willow tree, a beautiful willow tree off to the left. And it was a cove, like an inlet. And I'll never forget that. That's the image that's been etched in my head for a very long time. And the first experience, that was really pretty much it. I mean,
Say hello to Elaine Douglas, Thomas. I don't think you guys know each other.
Hello, Thomas.
Hi, Elaine. Hey, how
are
you?
Doing?
You emailed me a couple times. I'm doing pretty good. Not bad at all.
Well, that's good. That's real good.
I'm sorry?
That's real good.
Okay.
Basically, Thomas says this has gone on in his family and his grandmother. Did you tell me, Thomas, once that your grandmother's mother or parents had some sort of experience, or did it stop there with your grandmother?
Well, it started with my grandmother and my mother in 1954 when they were renting a cabin in Maine. It was, again, the fourth week of June. And oddly enough, that's when it's in UFO casebook, because it was in the same time frame that this airline, again, was going from New York to London. And it was the incident where they dispatched a fighter jet to intercept this craft was in Gooseneck Lake, and my parents were at Moosehead Lake. And the only thing dividing these lakes was a waterway. One was just over the line of Canada, and one was in Maine. So, and that was on June 29th, 1954. So they were right there at the same time. So there's a connection there we think that there's some relevance there. So my mother, what happened with her? She had been awoke at I guess it was late at night, and where she basically describes what she felt was being alive in a mannequin, is how she really words it. She heard the cracking of a noise in the room and tried to sit up and experienced a warm gripping sensation that wrapped around her like midsection, and she remembers this kept her in like a horizontal position, and says it was much like living inside a mannequin for several hours. I mean, she struggled to try to drag herself away. She could move her hands at her feet. She was choking. She was hyperventilating, and it was as if they were splitting at the bottom of her bed like a boat going through a wake, and these shorter figures were coming around her bed. And what was odd about that too is that there was a girl there. My Uncle Bob was there, my mother's brother, and had taken his girlfriend as well. And in the morning, they both woke up nauseated and had experienced the same thing in the same cabin in different rooms that night. So that was a tough night for them. And so then nothing really took place again from 1966, and we had something very similar in 77. But it wasn't until 1969 that we really had the four of us together in the station wagon. We were coming back from a horse show in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, actually. And we were heading down Route 7. And I'd competed in a horse show and got a brown ribbon. I was pretty upset about it. So they were taking me out for a bite to eat and ice cream and so on. And on the way back to the house. And so we were getting back a little bit later than normal. It was probably 9 o'clock or so. It was in September. And there was before that, I was in the back seat with my brother, and I was going to give him a fireball, a hot one of those little 2-cent fireballs or whatever, and I was taking it out of the packet. And my grandmother had turned around to look in the back seat to express that she felt he was too young for it. And so once she did so, she saw out the back of through the back of the station wagon, some lights in the woods, on off of the driver's side of the car. Now she, at the time, really wasn't sure what that was, but because it was so big, she referenced it as looking like a floating strip mall, is what it looked like today to her. And it came closer, and there was flashes of light, but the thing was, the hill on the left-hand side of our road was about 5 feet up, and the trees were above it. So even though she saw it, she lose sight of it because it was kind of above the car and above this tree line. And sure enough, it wasn't much longer. The station wagon came to a... it would stall like you've heard before. It just kind of went off to the side of the road. My mother controlled it off to the right. And there's this calm that's always been associated with what we experience. It's almost like a barometric change in pressure. And it'd be very silent. And then the car stopped. You could hear the stones coming from the tires on the bottom of the car, and then there was this eruption of crickets, and it was just everywhere. And then the four of us were in this huge holding area that was probably the size of 2 or 3 football fields. And that was at this, there was a wall behind me. I wasn't far off the wall, maybe 2 or 3 feet. And there was a wall to my right that was probably 5 or 6 feet away. And between me and the wall, there were some silver carts. At least they looked silver. And then the rest of this bay area was completely open. There was nothing there at all.
Hmm. Elaine, does this sound familiar, like other people have told you things similar to this, or is his experiences more unique?
I think one of the interesting things he said is in the first account, he was walking toward the craft, and he felt calm, and then he felt increasingly calm. What I have observed, I think that what the aliens are able to do with these implants is that under their control, they're able to evoke just any emotion that they want to evoke. And they have a repertoire. Certainly the emotion that they invoke, which is calming, is something they use all the time because they don't like abductees to struggle because it slows down the operation of what they're trying to do.
Thomas, do you have implants?
I don't believe so, but I have a theory on what calms us down as well, is that low-frequency magnetic field. My brother experienced after we felt that the droplets of blood had dropped out of his nose and onto his steering wheel. And we thought perhaps that low-frequency could have caused something like that. Or I know it slows down brain activity, so we've had radiation around our, it's well documented from police officers and detectives and STAR team and stuff had found high amounts of radiation and magnetic fields around our vehicles. So we are assuming, we don't know, but it would only make sense that maybe that could be part of what caused it. But again, we're grabbing at straws right now, but we've given it some thought.
It doesn't make sense that a normal man such as yourself would feel calm and walking toward an alien spacecraft. You probably would feel apprehensive, but what I'm getting at is that they're able to impose on you the emotional state that they want to impose, and they have a number of buttons that they can push. They have the ecstasy button that they can push if they need it. They can push the absolute crap your pants fear button that they push. They have the unconditional love button that they push. And I'm just saying that these emotional states, which are often created in experiencers in the midst of persuasive scenarios, like films and symbolic dramas that the aliens create, and then they'll push these emotional buttons. I think one of the ones that is probably the most powerful of the buttons that they're able to push is the unconditional love button, where abductees will report that they were in the presence of aliens and they felt unconditional love. And and it's absolutely persuasive to the abductee. They become totally convinced that the aliens unconditionally love them. And what I think is going on in those events is that there are technological means for invoking these emotions.
Thomas, do you love them or do you fear them, or how do you feel about
them? Well, there were times. I mean, again, we've had a couple of accounts, and I do remember in our notes from way back when we mentioned having like a godlike calm come over us, and everything seemed to be moving right, as if we were underwater. And, that was some time ago, but there have been different feelings that we felt. We felt, I've referenced this 3 moon feeling, like a heightened anxiety, but it's not really an anxiety. It's just like a heightened alertness, or you really can't sleep and you don't know why, and you just, you're much more alert. You can't explain it. There's been a lot of little feelings that come and go And that's something that I've made a lot of reference to. So there's definitely something to it. You know, we just believe that the magnetic field or magnetic part of it was probably caused by the craft itself, and that barometric pressure change might go hand in hand with that. But there has been a lot of additional, time.
Have you had an abduction experience recently, or did it just stop when you started going public?
Oh, no. Well, we didn't. We had our experiences were, well, not mine first, but my parents was 1954, and then 1966, 67, and 69 in New England. And then we didn't have anything happen to us till 2009. But in between, you know, there was a death of my father and a death of Blackman, and, of course, the people that were investigating it in 2009, a doctor died 8 weeks after going public. So there's
yeah, we're almost out of time. I urge people to listen to our interviews that we've done with you at jerrypippin.com. And we have as you know, we're doing an objective report on your cases and your father had a tragic end, but very interesting experiences right on through his life. And we'll explore all that in a show later in November or early December, so we'll let people know about that. Thomas, you got any parting words?
Yeah, I'd like to maybe bounce 1969 off Elaine. I never really got to finish it. She was talking about some of the things that she was interested in, but if I can just tell you what happened in 69 and see what Elaine feels about it, I'd really appreciate that. Do you have time for that?
Yeah.
Okay. When I was in when I was in this larger holding area, which is very similar to what Travis was in, actually, and this was all open to the left, the wall to the right, wall to the back of me, I had walked straight across this area. Again, there was a figure that had been standing in the doorway that was just adjacent to the one I was at, came in a few feet, took me out this walkway, and for the first time I was actually grabbed sternly on my left arm and taken down this hallway. Again, it was all very bright, very self-illuminating, and I went down about maybe 15 feet. I don't think it was more than that, and there was a T-junction that I came to, with another very thin hallway. You couldn't fit maybe three people down it at once. And I was taking a left and into this room. When I came into this room, there were three figures that I hadn't ever heard anyone else reference that really looked like this. They had large egg-shaped heads, very stick body figure, more of a teardrop type of body in the middle, very, very odd looking. And there were two that seemed to be facing a wall. When I came into this room, they were facing a wall, and they were working on something, I believe, embedded in the wall. And there was a table there off to the right, and there were two figures at the end of this table. I came in. It was very low. I was only 10 years old, and I was able to scoot right up on it, so it couldn't have been as high as an office desk. It was pretty small. It was a little whitish silver. I felt differently. We talk about feelings a lot, and I felt very differently here. I was very scared. There was no calm at this point. There was no, it was going to be okay at this point. I was very scared. And when this individual turned at this, I guess it was like more of an insect-looking thing, if I were to put it into a category, had turned towards me and had referenced or made a gesture to this individual at the bottom of this table I was on. I felt it was coming to me because it went and turned, and there were two pockets. This room had a cylinder, roundish cylinder to it, and they were in this left corner pocket of the cylinder, and off to the right corner corner of this room, and the cylinder was an opening. I thought I could go out. So I jumped off this thing, and I shot out to the right side of this cylinder and wall, and I stumbled into this huge intersecting hallway. It was almost like a basketball court with huge hallways where you could drive a bus down them. It was huge. And so I didn't know where to go. Moments later, I was taken back. This time I was placed on the table, and this what looked like a tanning bed top lowered over me. It had sides on it that went on each side of me. It had a large area in front where there would be room to move underneath it. It had oval or round shapes, holes in the sides of it. At that point, it lowered. I thought it was there to keep me from running again, which I would think would make sense. And through these holes on these sides, these individuals, these figures that were at the end of my bed, had taken these rocks, these roundish black rocks, they were a little bigger than marble, and they had a whitish pad on them. And one was placed on my leg, one was placed on my side, chest area, and one on my face, my mouth. And I went out. And then I was taken back to, apparently, maybe half an hour later, taken back to this holding area. But what's interesting about that is that's one of the few things that Travis had mentioned happened to him. So I just want to know if you've ever heard of anyone else having anything like that, because I don't really talk to
people. How about that, Elaine? Have you heard of anything about that?
Is it the technology that was employed there that is it the feeling tone, the purpose of the experience, or the technology? What? Tell me what is significant about that for you.
Well, I think that the fact we had these stones, they weren't perfectly round. They didn't look like a marble. Just like a marble-sized stone that was on a pad. And the only person I've ever found that had anything happen to him like that was Travis. And this thing that came out of off the top or above me that lowered down, this huge cover. I just never had anyone reference anything similar to that, and I was just curious since, you know, this is something that maybe you know more about than I do.
So you're wondering about the technology that was employed.
Would I like to know about it?
Yeah, that's what you're wondering about, right?
I'm wondering if you've ever heard of that happening with anyone else.
That particular description of a technology that was used there, no, I have not heard that exact description. Mm-hmm. But, you know,
okay.
Most people, if you dig down into their cases, will tell you something unique about and something inexplicable about the equipment, or some other feature of the abduction that is unique. And I understand how you want to find a reference point. You're hoping to find another case where that same equipment was used, because it will be reassuring to you that you know, and I understand that. And I wish I could provide you with that confirmation.
Okay, we have somebody in the chat room wanted to know if what you both are saying is there's a biological link between abductees. In other words, I think we pretty well covered that, and I believe that bloodlines, it seems to follow those. Both of you agree to that?
You mean that it's familial and generational?
Mm-hmm.
I believe that. I also believe that there's some connection with the Rh negative factor, and I also believe they're extracting hormones. When my brother, the wounds that my brother had on his chest, and I don't know if Elaine's heard this either, but there were two puncture wounds over my brother's gland that produces the immune system in his chest, just opposite the thyroid gland. It's on actually the side of the heart. And then there were two puncture holes behind the ear, which is the pea-sized gland that carries that immune system to the brain. And there were two marks there. So they were definitely extracting something from us. And there's a medical report about it, too, as well. So I believe it's biological, and I believe we're probably part of them.
Hi, Jerry. Steve Jones.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
I'm good. Doing very well, thank you.
We've been talking about the bad parts of ET abductions. You feel just the opposite, I understand. You've had, what, over 50 years of experiences? Why don't you tell our audience a little bit your take on all this?
Okay, if I can fit 50 years into the next few minutes, I will. My
that's radio for you. We're sorry.
Yeah, that's it. My experiences started when I was 5 years old. That is nearly 50 years ago. And from the ages of 5 to 12, my experiences were wonderful. They were an exciting thing that I used to look forward to. It was just a very, very normal part of my life, just like watching the TV or playing football with my friends. It was just something that happened. And then when I was 12, my perspective on the world changed because my mother left the family home, and when she left, she took my trust in the world with her. So the way that I viewed the world and the way that I viewed my contact experiences changed, because now I know my contact experiences didn't change, only how I perceived them. So from the age of 12...
Now, before we go any further, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I wanted to make sure the audience understands all this started in England, right?
That's right, in England. I'm over in America.
Okay, and then go ahead about the contacty stuff.
Okay.
I'm very curious, because you really, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but you really feel that they're here to help us.
Well, it's not so much that I think that they're here to help us, but I think that ET contact can be a positive thing. I think it's what we make it, Jerry. I personally think that not totally, but for the majority of contact experiences, they are the same. Now, depending on who you are as a human being, you will perceive them differently. So if you maybe you've had a very strict religious upbringing, you might perceive ETs as devils or as a bad thing. Now, I have no religious background, but what I've learned over the last last 10 years is that the ET contact is how I perceive it to be. So I have changed. Throughout the years, the contact didn't change, but I was fearful of it from the age of 12 till, about 10 years ago. But what I've discovered, that ET contact is not about them. ET contact is us. It is about us. It's a trigger. It's a trigger in our evolution to start looking at ourselves. ET contact can be whatever we want it to be. And I have decided, I'm not religious, I'm not new agey or anything like that. I'm just a normal run-of-the-mill guy. And I've allowed the ET contact experience to awaken me. I've decided that it's going to help me to become aware of my role as a human being. It's enabling me to become conscious. It's enabling me to start taking responsibility for my words and my actions in my day-to-day life, and that's what I've written about in my book. And ultimately,
yeah, let's talk about that book for a minute. It's available at Amazon.
Yes, it's available at Amazon. It's called An Invitation to the Dance. And that's pretty much what ET Contact has issued us. It's issued the human race with an invitation to the dance of life. And it is 2012 and everything that surrounds that. What it is, it's about us. It's about the human race beginning to wake up from the long sleep. The long sleep that was the age of Pisces. We come out of that, we go into the age of Aquarius, and we are waking up. When I was here in America earlier on this year for 4 months talking about my book at conferences, I was saying to everybody that the awakening is coming, and I didn't realize that it would arrive so soon. But what is happening down in Wall Street at the moment is a symbol. Wall Street is not a protest about money. It's just a platform for human beings to stand on and to say, we are not going to take the nonsense anymore. We are responsible human beings, and we want to say how our life is going to be. ET contact is, in a nutshell, it's a love story. It's as simple as that, Jerry. It's a love story. And we are finding something in our hearts and through the awakening of our consciousness that we are so much more than we have been up until this point. And my book is about my ET contact. It's that story, but there's so much more in my book, because there's so many books out there about ET contact, so I didn't want to write one just about that. My book is, as I say, it's a trigger, it's a wake-up call, it's an alarm call. It means that every single one of us, currently we believe we are just grains of sand, but as we come together, we become a beach, and we are a conscious awakening. And people talk about 2012 being a time of tragedy, of something to be scared of, but it's not. It is the end of life as we know it, but it is the beginning of something extremely wonderful. And I, for one, am so grateful that I have been born at this time, that I can be a part of it. The people that I've spoken to throughout this year are people not in the UFO community, because that's like preaching to the choir. My book is meant to be read by people that maybe have no knowledge of the UFO subject, because, as I say, the UFO phenomenon is not about little grey aliens, it's not about flying saucers, it's not about lights in the sky. And on that note, I think it's really important now that people start pushing this forward. You know, I hear a lot of callers talking about lights in the sky. This, and they talk about it as if it's the day after Roswell, and it is not. It is 2011, and we have to move this forward progressively. We have to move it forward. It belongs to us. Disclosure is never going to come from the powers that would be. The disclosure will come from human beings, because we've been living this life. People like myself, we've been living this life, and ET contact is something that goes back thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and
I understand what you're saying. It goes back, and we've been dealing with this for some time. You're going to be up at Taos at the symposium, I understand this lecture you're going to give up there is the last on this subject. You're kind of moving to a different direction. Is that right, or did I get the wrong information?
No, that's pretty much it, Jerry. When I was talking, I spent 4 months of this year talking at conferences right across America, and the majority of the talk was fine detail of my contact experiences. I told the story of what happened, and then I would close my talk on something else, something much greater, something what contact actually really means. So on that note, I have received new information from the ETs that I will speak about on Saturday the 29th. Now, 2 days before, on Thursday the 27th, I will speak about my ET contacts, probably for one of the last times in detail, because there is something far more important to be talking about and discussing and sharing. And on Saturday the 29th, I will spend the whole of my lecture on that day speaking about all these new things. I will be speaking about 2012. I'll be speaking about Elenin, what it really is. I'll be speaking about Vesta. I'll be speaking about a whole new group of things that are really, really important, much more important than little lights in the sky.
Now, people can go over there to that website and check it out and find out when you're speaking and make reservations or whatever. It's at the Cowchino Lodge in Taos. We're almost out of time, but I want to just be clear about this. You feel that this has been a life-changing experience for you, and it's a wake-up call, and that's the ET mission? Is that what you feel?
I would say that, in a nutshell, what I have got out of my ET contact is that I have let go of my fear. And I have not just let go of my fear of the ET contact, I've let go of my fear about life in general. I spent most of my life waking up with a knot in my stomach, and I believe I was made to feel like that. I was made to feel like that by the fear mongers, by the media, by the press. We are much easier to manage when we are scared, Jerry, and I ain't scared no more. And ET contact can enable everybody to stop being scared, to take responsibility for their lives and go out there and make our life experience something very, very positive, very constructive. And that's what I'll be speaking about at Taos.
Hey, thank you very much, Stephen, for being on. The time is almost up here. We appreciate you calling in and your perspective on it. And we'll see you in Taos.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Jerry.
Okay. And now, Thomas, are you still there? I know Elaine is. Elaine?
Yes.
Travis is here. Well, Jerry, I can hear you just fine. Can you hear me?
Okay, good. Is this Travis?
It is.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing fine.
We're talking a little bit. You're going to be up in Taos, too. I was just talking to Stephen Jones, and you're going to be doing something a little different up there. You have a little get-together, a little... why don't you tell our audience what you're planning on doing there? I think it's very interesting.
Just give a little bit of a workshop on kind of more of my more recent interpretations. To kind of follow along a little bit some of the things that your previous guest was talking about there.
So people, I think that it's a three-hour affair. And they can find out about that information on the symposium website. It's aspysymposium.com. You've had a little bit of a transformation over the years. We've been talking off and on for a long, long time, from Fire in the Sky to the recent times. You've become very interested in other people's ideas, I know, Travis, about their abduction experiences, and it runs the gamut.
I used to just kind of shut it out because I had enough just trying to deal with my own experience, but it's time to kind of look around and see what the bigger picture is, and interpreting my own experience over time, I've come to, what happened, but the way I interpret it is kind of evolved a bit, I think I've come to understand it a little better.
Well, what is your opinion about how the ZTs dealt with you? Has it changed? Originally you thought they were evil incarnate, I think.
Well, not exactly, but I was, at the moment it was happening, I was, extremely terrified, and, it came off as completely negative at the time. But I've come to understand that that had more to do with the circumstances that I found myself in. I'm regaining consciousness in a lot of pain. I'm having trouble breathing. The suffocating feeling was really adding to the panic. I was in a very claustrophobic, dimly lit room, having a lot of trouble breathing. So combine that with the pain and all that, suddenly seeing these creatures that, under those conditions, just kind of set me off as being, a negative experience. And I don't really know that, they set it up that way or planned it that way at all. I would think that it was just more of a circumstance. I'm thinking that the reason I regained consciousness at all was because they were unable to maintain control over me telepathically because of injury that I received by being struck by this energy from the being. And that kind of scrambled my neural circuits to the point where they couldn't maintain their control. And then when they came around towards me and there was that point in time in which they were staring at me, all three of them, in this very intense way that I found so troubling, and the reason, it became part of my nightmares was I think now that perhaps they were trying to reassert control by all three of them doing this at the same time, and it wasn't working. Because I was, getting ready to make some defensive, offensive moves, and they just suddenly split, which, was probably because they...
Yeah, Travis, I wish we had more time to talk. This is really great that you called in, and we'll see you in Taos. And I know, don't you have some outtakes or something from Fire in the Sky you're going to show?
We're going to show the whole movie.
Yeah. That's what I thought. People need to check all that out, and appreciate you calling in, and thanks very much. We'll talk to you later. Elaine Douglas, are you there?
I am. I'm here.
We only got a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
So it's your floor.
Well,
the microphone is yours.
the British doll, I found him very interesting. One of the postures that the aliens assume, in fact, it's a central posture of theirs, is we're okay, you're not okay. Meaning we, the alien in front of you and the alien civilization that is represented here, we're okay and you're not okay. And this this message is delivered relentlessly by the aliens to the abductees, to many abductees, throughout their conditioning process. And it generally, where it ends up is it feeds off of guilt. I was talking earlier about Jim Sparks, and I was showing you how they seduced him by his own narcissism. And I found that the emotions, if you're prone to either guilt or narcissism, you're very vulnerable to the aliens. If they can persuade you to take your attention off of what they're doing, what they may represent, and start thinking about yourself and the human race and whether we're okay or not okay, whether we're a bad people or not bad people, they will, because they like you in that posture where you are very concerned about yourself and your own adequacy, and you feel guilty about the sins and crimes of the human race.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens?
Well, we're out of time, Elaine Douglas. We recommend people to contact you. You will have we have information about you on our website, and people need to get that magazine when it comes out next time, and we'll have to do another show. And folks, we are out of time, and we had lots of calls we didn't get to. We'll have to try it again sometime. Elaine Douglas, I appreciate you being on.
Entirely my pleasure. Entirely my pleasure.
I don't know if Thomas Reed is still there. If he is, Thomas, thanks for being on. Hey, thanks, everyone. We'll talk to you later. I'm Jerry Pippin, and this has been our Abduction Special.